believe from the goal of regime change in Ukraine that Putin pursued with starting the invasion. Now, as a result of sanctions and weapon support, the demands of Russia are seemingly much more realistic, I would say so. So now they recognize that there is no way that they would be able to remove Zelensky's government from Kyiv. They retreated from northern Ukraine. In effect, understanding that they don't have enough forces to take Kyiv, and now they perhaps are trying to concentrate the forces in order to inflict a major defeat to Ukraine in Donbas. The things that they're negotiating right now are about the neutral status for Ukraine, which at this moment, when Ukraine sees that NATO is not going to defend Ukraine, as many people were saying this before, that the neutral status is something acceptable for Ukraine. There are more like difficult things, as demilitarization and whatever Putin would accept as denazification, because it, basically it's an empty word and many things could be put there. And of course, the most difficult question about recognition of Crimea annexation and like effective future annexation of Donbas, that's a result of recognizing so-called independence of Donetsk and Luhansk republics. But these are already the positions from which the meaningful negotiations could start. And of course, the outcomes of this negotiation would be decided on the battlefields. That would work if there is also in parallel very active diplomatic brokerage of a compromise peace settlement. Yes, we increase support for Ukraine in order to bring Putin to the earth from his imperial ambitions. But at the same time, we are actively trying to broker a stable peace settlement acceptable for both Russia and Ukraine that would bring that would stop the war as soon as possible. If that would be a part of the Western strategy, the sending of weapons and sanctions would be justified, in my opinion. But if, for example, Boris Johnson is saying that there is no even need to continue negotiations with Putin, then it looks in a quite different perspective. Because if you simply continue to send weapons and increase sanctions, that means that you are rather interested in prolonging the war and indeed in turning Ukraine into kind of like Afghanistan in Europe, with thousands, hundreds of thousands lives lost, with cities destroyed, with the economy bombed into pre-modern stage, in order to use Ukraine against Russia with some idea of perhaps bringing down Putin or even dismantling the huge Russian state. In this perspective, this would look completely differently. But in principle, I would not see sending weapons.
Here, a nuanced response, I think something very important to consider for the peace movement, and I guess a big part of that decision is to push our governments to not be like Boris Johnson, and basically say that no negotiations are needed. We've been talking for almost a full hour. I want to give people the chance to ask questions themselves directly to you. People can put those questions in the chat, or they can turn on their microphone and ask them directly to you. I don't see any questions yet, so I'll wait a few seconds. And and if people are too shy, I'm happy to just continue with all the questions that I wasn't able to ask, because you gave very good and very comprehensive answers, so I didn't manage to get to all of them. But yeah, I'll give people a few seconds now.
All right, could I start with a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, first of all, I want to say I feel very sorry what's happening in Ukraine, especially for the people over there. But in my opinion, I think there's a war being fighting between America, especially, and Russia over the territory in Ukraine, over the influence in Ukraine, and that the Ukrainian people are the victims of this war between America and Russia about territory in the world. Having said that, I also want to ask you guys, what you exactly know about Zelensky's main sponsor, Ihor Kolomoisky. He's a Ukrainian oligarch, and Zelensky worked for him from his early days through his television station, OnePlus1, and also he announced his presidency for the election through that television, and also that television hosted advertisement for Zelensky's election campaign. I also looked up and saw that from Studio 95, if I'm correct, the studio who produced the series Servant of the People, where Zelensky was the main actor, that the CEO of this studio, part of 95, I remember now, is now the head of secret intelligence in Ukraine. And the scenario writer of Servant of the People is now the first advisor of President Zelensky. But let's go back to Ihor Kolomoisky. He only didn't have a long connection with Zelensky. I also read through Chris Pluk investigation that Ihor Kolomoisky was also the end owner of Burisma. Burisma, where the son of the current president of America worked for, Hunter Biden. And I also saw that some other American board members were there in Burisma. That, and at the end, through the company Seneca, also financed biolabs in Ukraine and gave also patents to investigate with anthrax. Of course, Putin also said that before, I think 10 days ago, about Hunter's Biden influence in Ukraine and what he did there. So I don't know if I could believe that America was really financing weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine. But I want to ask you guys, what do you know about the influence of Igor Kolomoisky on Zelensky? And, well, about maybe the people around Igor Kolomoisky. The last notice I want to say, I also saw that Igor Kolomoisky plundered the Ukrainian people to his private bank.
I think the question is clear. I want to give the word to Vladimir because we also need to have time for other questions. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the yeah. questions.
I'm sorry for the long question. It's more
all right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the question. Just a first remark. The war could be perceived as one of the outcomes of the inter-imperialist rivalry about Ukraine. And of course, NATO is not innocent in the story of Ukraine and bears some responsibility. But the primary responsibility for the start of the war is on Putin, because he pressed the button and he had actually other choices. Considering all the processes that were connected to NATO, to the political developments in Ukraine, there have been other options for Putin. And if he chose the war, he bears the primary responsibility also for the all the horrors and loss of lives and destruction that is happening in Ukraine. Returning back to Kolomoisky, just to try to answer this as short as possible, Kolomoisky is indeed one of the richest and the most notorious oligarchs in Ukraine that built his fortune on quite outrageously. Exploitation of some of the selective preferences of the state that he, in a corrupt way, lobbied for himself, and also guilty in moving like billions out of Ukraine into the offshore accounts, and private bank was actually part of this scheme. Saying that, and Kolomoisky is like widely hated in Ukraine, and he also has trouble with the United States. I believe he spent for some time in Israel because he was hiding from Ukrainian justice. When Zelensky won the elections, Kolomoisky indeed came back to Ukraine. I'm saying that Kolomoisky is an actual sponsor or even kind of like a mastermind behind Zelensky would be just false. Indeed, Kolomoisky supported Zelensky during the elections. And you were right about the role of Kolomoisky's own TV channel. Kolomoisky had a huge conflict with Poroshenko, and he was supporting Zelensky primarily because of this. And there was a history of business partnership between Zelensky and Kolomoisky, although it would be an exaggeration to say that Zelensky was kind of like working for Kolomoisky. There is quite a murky story of Zelensky and Kolomoisky appearing in so-called Pandora Papers, the papers that were published about the offshore companies, where some of the a company linked to Zelensky also appeared. And I mean, that was a cause of quite considerable scandal that decreased the support for Zelensky in Ukraine. And some connections in these offshore deals with Kolomoisky could also be seen in those papers. I would not say that Kolomoisky is kind of like influencing Zelensky's policies in any significant way. Kolomoisky was not really prosecuted for what he has done stealing from Ukraine, but he has also not was not really getting out of all troubles. So the Zelensky also understands that the actual connections with Kolomoisky would be very toxic for him, for Zelensky himself, and he's not trying to fully alienate Kolomoisky, but at the same time, and yeah, Kolomoisky sponsored parliamentary groups were important for passing some of the decisions for which very messy Zelensky's party was not capable to mobilize the majority, which they actually had in the parliament. But I mean, that was extremely diverse and poorly organized party. So in this sense, Kolomoisky was cooperating with Zelensky, but I would not say that he was kind of like imposing his agenda on Zelensky.
I think that's a clear response. I'm going to go to some of the other questions in the chat. So we have one question asking, what about the story that was published last year in Time magazine about a plan from Eric Prince, former CEO of Blackwater, I believe, to finance a private army in Ukraine? And what about the role of private militias in the proxy war in the Donbas, mainly Azov battalion on the one hand and Wagner group on the other? And actually, I think maybe I can throw in one more question there, which asks, can the fight of the rebels in Donbas be considered as a national liberation struggle? What is the class basis of this struggle and where do they stand ideologically?
Oh no, that's just too many questions and very, very different. Honestly, I very poorly recall that story about Eric Prince, and I'm not sure. As I recall, that was just a plan that has never been realized. Why? Honestly, can't say. The private militias, I mean, Azov is not actually a private militia. It's a very wrong understanding of what Azov is. Azov was created by far-right activists of quite extreme background. Andriy Beletsky was the first commander of Azov. And since that, quite soon, Azov was integrated into the National Guard structure, which was subservient to the Minister of Interior, Arsen Avakov, one of the powerful Ukrainian oligarchs. But Azov should never be seen as some kind of like private militia for Avakov. Azov and Avakov had rather kind of like mutually beneficial relations, both politically and also in kind of like enforcement business. But even after Avakov was dismissed from the minister office last year, Azov has been still doing quite well. So they've shown themselves as like relatively independent force. The other problem with Azov, of course, is this whole far-right stuff, the use of the wolf's uncle symbol, the start of the kind of like full-scale far-right movement with the National Corps Party, with the paramilitary organization, with all these summer camps for children and so on and so forth, with the international dimension, creating quite extensive links with the Western far right. So that's a big story, and it's been covered quite extensively, even in the Western media, because they clearly understand that something like Azov is truly extraordinary for Europe, at least. So And the actual role of Azov, I think it's usually exaggerated. And it is true that Azov is now playing an important role in the defense of Mariupol, of the large city in the southern Ukraine, which is now under extreme assault from the Russian forces, leading to massive destruction of a city of about 500,000 people. And Azov plays an important role in defense of the city. But in the overall structure of Ukrainian forces, I mean, the groups of like Azov with the far-right connections are not actually very typical.
Maybe if I can follow up on that, what do you think of, I've seen some analysis from Ivan Kachanovsky a few times and another Ukrainian political scientist, and I mentioned this in my book as well, that some of the influence of the far right in Ukraine is can maybe be better understood not in their specific numbers or their support, but also in their kind of threats that they sometimes issue against the Ukrainian government, for example, when they want to do any compromise with Russia, which is kind of painted as traitors and things like this. Would you consider their influence in this way? Do you think that they have that there is any real fear within, for example, Zelensky's government to compromise because of a threat from the far right, or do you think that's overblown?
I mean, I've been always writing the same in my own studies of Ukrainian far right and post-Euromaidan politics. Many people are just stopping at the moment when they see the how few votes the nominally far right party received at the Ukrainian elections, and they say, "Well, what are you talking about? These guys cannot get even more than 3%. So just look at Le Pen, or look at Hungarian Fidesz, or any other large Western far-right party that is actually capable to get a significant number of parliamentary seats. But of course, the real power of Ukrainian far-right, and that's why they were so extraordinary for Europe, that lied in their capacity for street mobilization, in their capacity for, in their much stronger legitimacy within the Ukrainian civil society, and lack of any institutionalized barrier between the liberal and far-right part of the civil society, which is very unusual for Western Europe, and total lack of any left-wing part of active public that was repressed after the 2014. And also the integration into the enforcement structures of Ukrainian state, control of the weapons, support of the people like Arsen Avakov from the top positions of the government. That, of course, gave Ukrainian far right a disproportionate influence in Ukrainian politics. And at some critical moments, they could influence the governmental decisions. They could push forward for their own agenda, as I've just beginning our conversation in the, from the very start. The far right were truly a minority among the Euromaidan participants, but they were able to benefit a lot from the outcomes of the Euromaidan revolution and push forward the agendas which were not actually really popular, even among the participants, not speaking the total population of Ukraine. And their threats, very explicit violent threats against the implementation of the Minsk Accords, that were also part of the story. In 2015, Svoboda is a far-right party in Ukraine, So an, a Svoboda activist threw a hand grenade into a police line during the voting for the autonomy status for Donbas, and he killed four police officers and injured, I believe, about 100. And that was already a very clear threat from the far right that they would not allow a real progress in Minsk implementation. And the threats were repeated very explicitly in 2019 when Zelensky was thinking about making some actual progress about Minsk, discussing so-called Steinmeier's formula that gave some algorithm for implementing the Minsk Accords.
Right. It's again a comprehensive answer. I wanna flag up one of the questions I kind of threw in earlier, because I know you've written quite extensively also about the left in or the in existence rather of the left in Ukraine and specifically also Donbas. So the question was, can the fight of the rebels in Donbas be considered as a national liberation struggle? What is the class basis of this struggle, and where do they stand ideologically?
That's a super complicated question. That's probably I missed it before. I mean, you should start from how organic is the actual struggle for Donbas, because the armed revolt was started by a Russian nationalist who was a former FSB, Russian Security Service officer, retired just very recently before the war in Donbas. This very clear reactionary Russian nationalist monarchist agenda, he's truly a far-right ideological activist. And he gathered an armed group that currently crossed the border with Ukraine. And they crossed the border with the arms, and that already raises a suspicion that the Russian government could know a lot about their plans. And of course, it's still not very clear to which extent Igor Strelkov, that's the name of the person who started the separatist revolt in Donbas, to which extent his own plans were the plans of Kremlin, Putin, but there is very strong suspicion that he was coordinating at least with some influential people close to the government. Success of the revolt would ultimately be impossible without the covert Russian support, first with weapons, then with actual incursion of regular Russian forces in 2014 and in 2015. So to which extent you would find here a national liberation struggle, I mean, national liberation struggle for Russians in Ukraine. I mean, Russia is, could be considered an imperialistic nation. So if you would see this in the nationalistic terms, you would rather need to look at it as a clash of nationalism, of Russian nationalism and Ukrainian nationalism. And at this moment when Russia is waging like a clear aggression in Ukraine, and where the Donetsk and Luhansk republics are like clearly on Russian side against Ukraine, whether would you consider this a national liberation struggle? That would be like a very extreme, abuse of the sport.
Thanks, Vladimir. I'm wanting to round up. There is one last question from Jeff, saying, you said that the Maidan uprising was never supported by a majority of the population, but if there had been a democratic outcome and compromise supported by the majority, and he's talking kind of a what if in 2013, would it still not have been a shift to the left, resulting in a more liberal direction and lessening the power of the oligarchs? And regarding the pool between Russia and NATO before 2014, weren't the vast majority of Ukrainians in support of neutrality? So what the situation was basically around that time and what a democratic outcome at the time would have looked like. Of course, this is a kind of what if question, but yeah, that's the last question from the audience.
So the Euromaidan was not actually about NATO. It was about the association agreement with the EU, which was seen by many Ukrainians as a kind of like a first step towards EU membership, although it was not. It was primarily a free trade agreement with some abstract words about corruption, democracy, and so on. But primarily this was about free trade zone. And as we actually have been saying this from the very start, and as this have been recognized lately by many Ukrainian people in the government, in business, that the terms of the free trade zone with the EU were not favorable for Ukrainian economy for many different reasons. The distribution of the attitudes about EU before the Euromaidan protest started was more like split. It was not actually about neutrality. It was about something like 40-45% who supported EU integration, and about maybe 35-40% who supported integration with the Russia-led Eurasian Union. At that moment, it was called Customs Union. It's Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. So there was an initiative to have an actual referendum on the EU on the choice between EU or the Customs Union, but that initiative was kind of like undermined by Yanukovych government, which made a huge number of mistakes that resulted in toppling of Yanukovych. And about NATO, before 2014, the support for NATO was actually a small minority within Ukrainian society, less than 20%. Most of Ukrainians were split between those who supported a military alliance with Russia, and that sounds extremely ironic and tragic at this moment, and those who were supporting staying at non-alignment status for Ukraine. After the Euromaidan, the support for Russia went down, because of the annexation of Crimea, because of the war in Donbass. And many people started to see NATO as a kind of like protection against Russia, and support for NATO increased up to 40%. But until the last year, it was hardly ever above 50. So claiming the real majority within Ukraine, and we also need to understand that since 2014, the polling companies stopped doing surveys in Russia next Crimea and in the separatist controlled Donbass. So that pro-NATO attitudes were skewed because of the exclusion of the most pro-Russian regions in Ukraine. And so during the war, it's just simply very difficult to organize a proper survey. And it would be very interesting to know whether the war and the perception of NATO and how and the actual lack of support from NATO, how it influences the attitudes of Ukrainians. Is it up because of the war started by Russia, or it's actually down because of the disappointment about NATO?
Thank you very much, Vladimir. I have to start rounding up now. We're exactly at time, so I want you thank you so much for joining us and illuminating us with all your insights, which are very important at this moment. I want to thank everybody for tuning in, of course. As I said, this was Decolonial Learning Session number 15. We have one every month, so feel free to join. To track our agenda and join for the next one. In this case, we actually, because this was a special session, we have another one coming Thursday about Dutch colonialism in Indonesia. There is a link for donations in the chat. We're all doing this voluntarily, so any donations are helpful. And that's it. I want to thank you all for coming, I'm gonna stop the recording now, but feel free to hang out a little bit. I won't immediately shut down the Zoom session, so if you want to talk amongst each other, that's very welcome. Again, thank everyone for joining, and that was it.
Yeah, thank you for listening and for very interesting questions.
The recording has stopped.
Yeah, sorry, but I would need to leave because it's yeah, I need to
Of course.
yeah
Of course, I.
to let our room.
You're listening to The Rhetoric of Cancer on the World Service with me, Andrew Greystone.
So where does the story begin, Andrew?
I guess it begins about 4 years ago in a windowless office in the hospital in Manchester, where a doctor looked up from an orange cardboard folder and said, "You have cancer."
Gosh.
And in a sense, the second half of my autobiography starts from that moment. For me, the journey with cancer from that point on was as much a journey of the mind, a spiritual journey, as it was a physical process of dealing with the cancer. And I found that as I told my friends and family about it, I was struggling to find a good language to describe what was going on.
What did you find problematic with the language?
Well, I found that a lot of the language of cancer was very masculine, military sort of language. People said to me, "You're strong, you're brave, you'll be able to fight this." And I thought, I'm not sure if I am strong or brave, and I'm not really the fighting type. Are there other ways that we can describe this experience? So I've wanted in this program to meet with a number of people who encounter cancer in different ways, and to explore with them the rhetoric, the language that they use to talk about cancer. First, I went back to the Christie Hospital in Manchester in the UK, where I was treated for my cancer. And I met in the hospital waiting room with Dr. Wendy Makin, who's the Macmillan consultant in palliative care and oncology. I wanted to find out what language clinicians use to describe cancer and whether Dr. Makin felt there's any value in using this battling metaphor to describe people's experience of cancer.
I think that for all of us, if you open a paper or see something on the news, whether it's a celebrity or someone in the local community who sadly has died of their cancer, the language is all around losing the fight, losing the battle. Now, I think partly that might be around media sensationalism. But I think there's something else there as well. I think there is a recognition that for many people, dealing with cancer, living with it and dying from cancer can be a struggle. And I think that sometimes that language is used by their family, by the people they work with, their friends, really out of respect and recognition of what that person has gone through, that they dealt with it in the best way they could, very bravely. And we often see this in people living with their cancer. But the bottom line is that people need some way of making sense of all of this and to find their way of how they're going to deal with it, how they're going to get through it, or live alongside it.
Live alongside it is very interesting language for me. Live with the experience, live with cancer.
I sometimes use that to help people put cancer in perspective, particularly if it's someone who also has had ischemic heart disease, angina, had coronary bypass operations, or they've got chronic chest problems. In reality, they've been living alongside other life-threatening conditions, but they haven't seen it in the same way as they now see their cancer, and their cancer makes them far more frightened. And sometimes that fear is disproportionate.
Yes, and the fear has come from the bogeyman that we've created, that we've made cancer as a culture. It's made it harder. There was more than 3 years between my being diagnosed with cancer and my being treated, so I had quite a long time of living with cancer and carrying it around with me and taking it to every social occasion and taking it to bed with me and waking up with it. So I learned to live with these cells, these rogue cells.
So what are the things, when you look back, that helped you in getting your head around the knowledge of the cancer?
It helped me to be able to own those cancerous cells as a part of my body and something that I had created, not something that had come in from outside or an invading force, but a part of me, like any other part of me. I don't like all the parts of my body equally. Some of them I like fairly much, and some of them I dislike a bit more. But I have to learn to love the bits of my body that I don't like so much. And I had to try to love these cancer cells, because I didn't want to declare a civil war in my own body. I didn't want to be a battleground. It doesn't help anyone to hate their own body. Wendy introduces this idea of living alongside cancer, which I find quite helpful. But Wendy was also conscious that we're dealing with a bogeyman, a monster that we've created. Now, some of that comes through the kind of advertising and public discussion that we see of cancer. So I wanted to meet somebody who's involved in the business of promoting cancer research and fundraising for that. So I went to a very modern, busy office in the centre of London to meet Natasha Hill, who's the Director of Brand and Strategic Marketing at Cancer Research UK. And I asked her how they describe cancer in ways that encourage people to give money to cancer research.
More recently, we've started to personify cancer a little bit more, which is something that we never used to do.
What do you mean by that? How does that work out?
We've started to get into territories where we think of cancer as an enemy, which is language that many patients, survivors, carers of cancer patients refer to.
An enemy. Yes, I've seen some posters, I think come from you, saying things like, cancer, the gloves are off.
Yes.
Cancer, you and me outside now, which is fighting talk.
Yes, so that was our Race for Life advertising.
And that's turning cancer into a
as a person,
yes, a thing, yes, that you want to fight. So the
and
main
speak to directly,
exactly.
Yeah.
And the main line for that campaign was "Cancer, we're coming to get you."
Yeah, it's quite threatening. It's kind of
yes,
it's fuzzy
and
talk,
that
isn't
that
it?
One that campaign in particular, we did a lot of work with consumers before going into that. It was a very new area for
so
us.
So lots of people like that kind of talk or respond well to
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah. If we're talking to people who are, say, over 60, we use very different language to the Race for Life campaign, where it's probably the most provocative that we've been before.
I had two things to worry about when I got cancer. The big fight against cancer as a whole that I want to see, you know, eradicated by research. But I also have my own little collection
yes.
of cancer cells, and I didn't want to fight them because they were mine, they were part of me. And I didn't want to declare a kind of civil war in my own body. I needed to find a better way of living with the cancer that I'd got.
But presumably you'd rather those cancer cells went away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, what language would you prefer to refer to those cancer cells going away?
Well, I'm still struggling to find a good language for it. I lived with cancer for over 3 years, knowing that I had cancer before I had any treatment to remove it. And it was a bit like giving hospitality to an unwelcome guest.
Mm.
But I didn't want to fight it because I don't want to fight myself.
But if it was, and maybe that's your particular type of cancer, but if it was a cancer that was going to progress and could cause a premature death, you'd want to fight that, wouldn't you?
Except there's hardly anything I can do to fight it. I couldn't operate on myself. I couldn't... what could I do to fight my own cancer? I was very passive in it.
And I suppose that is...
And yet I was being told, you've got to fight this thing.
By others.
I found that difficult, yeah. Well, I thought I was. I thought that's what people were saying.
That's unusual for most cancers. So prostate cancer is a particular cancer where it can be controlled. And people can live with it.
But even if you've got a cancer that needs treatment very urgently or that's very severe, most of us as patients can't do much fighting ourselves.
No, but what we know about some patients is this, sometimes the fight for them means an emotional commitment to doing everything that they can to make sure they're eating healthily through their treatment, to getting the rest so that they are supporting, if you like, the treatments that are given to them through the, you know, the experts,
yeah.
Be that, you know, surgery or chemotherapy, radiotherapy, drugs, etc., that they want to take part in doing their bit.
I've come to the Henry Wellcome Building at the University of Birmingham, and I'm here with Professor Michael Overdin, who is the Professor of Structural Biology within the School of Cancer Sciences here. We're outside a bare white room with the most enormous structure in the middle of it. Could you explain what that is?
Sure. The magnet looks a bit like a lunar lander, but it's actually designed to peer into the smallest parts of life, the proteins that are involved in controlling how cells grow and divide, how they move. And what our job is as scientists is to figure out how those molecules work, what really makes them tick, what they look like in space, and how to stop them from misbehaving in, for example, a cancer cell.
Do your colleagues here who are researching into cancer think of themselves as engaging in a battle?
The battle analogy is a peculiar one. In the end, we're scientists, we want to be objective. And so it's not something I'm typically using on my day-to-day job. But then again, I work with companies that design warheads for cancer. So warheads are small parts of drug molecules. Exactly. It's a very specific term that refers to the part of a drug molecule that hits the target. And
a target?
A target, exactly. And so we use these analogies in part because science can be a bit dry. Here we generate lots of numbers, and we want to be able to have metaphors to make it much more real and personal.
So you need metaphors too, like I've needed metaphors for dealing with cancer.
I think we always deal with metaphors. It makes it much more understandable. There's more drama to it. In the end, it's pretty hard knows what we're doing. We're trying to design a few atoms that work together to hit a part of a protein and stop it from behaving in the way that causes cancer. And so we, at the same time, need to avoid all the other proteins that are involved in the cancer. And so it's about developing a very specific targeted approach where we just hit the one protein and don't hit the other 20,000 proteins that might be doing their job normally in the
collateral
human body.
Collateral damage.
Exactly. And I think we use these metaphors to simplify it. And also it helps with funding agencies that are fighting for funding to describe what they're up against as a battle. I think it's more difficult for the patient because it's difficult to be at war with part of yourself. It seems counterintuitive, almost wrong, to think of a war against something that's in your body, that's from your own body.
That's what I felt as well.
Sure. So I think at a personal level, it doesn't make sense. But at the level of the murkiness of science and trying to find simple solutions that hopefully do have the profound outcomes that we want, i.e. stopping cancer, it helps us, I guess, simplify that.
Do you know where the metaphor of the war on cancer came from?
The metaphor came from the U.S. when Nixon announced the war on cancer. They wanted to beat cancer and do it quickly. And the reality is, we found since then that it isn't easy, it isn't quick, and it's an ongoing journey. And I think we really need to not talk about being at war with ourselves, but really have compassion and understanding of what the individual patient needs to go through.
Is there any other language, other than the language of warfare, that's been helpful to you in thinking about cancer?
In the end, I focus on the names of the individual proteins, the genes, the molecules, and that's really the playground of the scientists, free of the kind of the more negative metaphors. That's what I work with on a day-to-day basis. And so there's this whole playground of molecules working together with a purpose to keep a cell, a tissue, an organ functioning. And we're just now trying to understand what the puzzle pieces are within a cell. I think the next step is really to see how those puzzle pieces all fit together. And then finally, in a cancer cell, for example, how they don't fit together.
I like the fact that you're exploring, you're puzzling this out, that you're not necessarily coming into work with a furrowed brow because you've got something to fight, but you're being inquisitive on my behalf about the way this thing works or doesn't work. Is battling the best metaphor for what's actually going on at cellular level, or are there other ways of describing it?
We think of cells as having many switches, like a lot of light switches, and they need to be turned on or off depending on whether it's time to grow or time to stop growing. And so each protein in a cell, and there are many, acts like a switch. They communicate with one another. And so we think of cells as a system of relays and connections, not really a battle where you win and lose, more as a symphony, like a series of sounds and messages and communications that have to work together to create something beautiful, life. And when you start to get notes that play wrong, that are dissonant, and cancer cells don't grow properly, then you get problems.
If you've got an orchestra and one of the instruments is playing out of tune, you don't go in and vomit, you go in and retune it.
That's a good analogy, I like that. And that's what we're trying to do with a small molecule. You go and fix the instrument or maybe retrain the musician. And so here we're trying to design very small molecules that do a big job, that get that cancer cell back on track.
The thing that struck me most in meeting Michael was his tremendous sense of awe at seeing how the human body works at that tiny microscopic level. He seemed to think that cells were wonderful things.
Yeah.
But it was in the context of spending his life amazed at the way the human body works.
Yes, that's very clear, isn't it? There's that reverence, really, for the mystery of it. And then trying to find a way to tactfully intervene in that process.
To work along with it instead of against it.
Exactly, yeah. So where did you need to go next? What was the next part of the journey?
Well, I went all the way to the furthest northwestern tip of Wales to meet Jim Cotter, who is a poet and priest who's had cancer in a much more severe way than I did, and it's brought him close to the end of his life. So I wanted to hear his perspective.
I was diagnosed with a form of leukemia in August 2011. So I've been living with this for a couple of years, had 18 months, quote-quote, remission, not a phrase I'm comfortable with. It sounds as though you've been let out of prison early for good behaviour. I prefer to think of it as an unfolding drama in an unknown, as yet unknown, number of acts. The intermission is an interval, and you don't quite know whether it'll be two or three. I think the most vivid metaphor that was used was not by the head of department, as it were, but one of his colleagues. And he said, well, your bone marrow has become rather like a garden that's been taken over by the weeds. And we send in a weed killer, which unfortunately devastates the whole garden, and you become like a... Well, no, he didn't use this. It was my, I thought of pictures of battlefields of the First World War, you know, where everything is devastated that's living. But then he's, you know, he said that the good plants will come back again, but it was weed killer. In other words, you are matching force with force. And I think at a microbiological level, which I don't understand as a scientist at all, that is what is going on. The cancerous cells, they're like clones. They multiply, they spread devastation through the countryside because they're looking for food to eat the whole time. And I certainly think at that level, the picture of a sort of goose-stepping army is vivid, fairly accurate and quite alarming. And as with war itself, you know, this is not something we would choose, but, you know, you have to ask, is this war just and whose side are you on? At certain points.
So you did feel that you were conscripted into a battle at that stage?
Well, probably like yourself, I'm not entirely at ease with that series of war pictures. And I also thought to myself, well, this is something which is part of my own bloodstream. It's mine. And how do we get on? And is there another way of getting on rather than one lot trying to obliterate the other lot? The image comes of can I give safe harbour or even hospitality to this unwelcome entity? I did have conversations with this somewhat clumsy giant called Luke Kemia, who then turned into a heavyweight boxer. And I was having a number of bouts and ring. That was a way of beginning to cope with my relationship with the cancer. I find myself thinking of and talking about light and dark, and light angels and dark angels.
Yes.
And Wilco, the poet, talks a lot about dark angels.
And cancer is a dark angel.
Well, you see, yes, and is it necessarily for ill? Now that gets onto a different level of this, because we've come to expect a longer lifespan than our parents, nor certainly our grandparents. This is where the angel that seems to be dark actually is the messenger of your dying. Well, I've got to have some messenger. You know, I'm not going to live forever.
I was reading the obituary of a colleague the other day, and it said, as they so often do, he lost his battle with cancer.
Yeah.
And I thought, if somebody writes in my obituary, he lost his battle with cancer, I should come back and haunt them.
Yes.
All the people I've met and talked to in making this programme have been inspiring in their own way. Mm. They all seemed as if cancer had given them a sense of life,
exactly,
and immediacy,
exactly,
and urgency, and in a very strange way, it's been a gift.
Yes, or rather they've used it as a gift.
Or they've used it as a gift.
It is what it is, but they've turned it into a gift. Yeah.
Part of the picture for me is that I come to this as a believing Christian, and I wanted some help to pull this journey together, so I went to see an old friend, Paula Gooder, who is a Christian theologian who has a lot of insight into the way that a Christian faith understands good and evil.
Certainly in the New Testament, particularly in books like the Book of Revelation right at the end, you've got this image of battle used solely, really, for fighting against the powers of evil, fighting against the devil and his angels. That's the language where battling comes up time and time again in the New Testament. And it is interesting to note, isn't it, that when we fall back on a metaphor for describing our relationship with illness, we fall back on the metaphor that's most often used of evil. I wonder whether there is an at least implicit connection there between illness and evil.
I'm wondering if it's possible for me to say illness is a bad thing, cancer is a bad thing, and I'd rather it didn't exist, and I'd rather it wasn't in the world. But it's not necessarily an evil. It might be just part of the way the world is. Leaves fall from the trees.